A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
This week's prompt asks about the scale of Palestinian detention in Israeli prisons. How many are held for security offenses? How that compares to Israel's regular incarcerated population? And which maximum security facility houses the largest share? The prompt also notes the recent scrutiny around administrative detention. So let's start with the raw numbers and what they actually mean.
As of this month, May 2026, the Israeli Prison Service reports approximately 9,200 Palestinian security detainees in custody. That's West Bank and Gaza Palestinians held under military law for what Israel classifies as security offenses, not criminal cases in the civilian courts.
9,200. And for context, what's Israel's total prison population?
Roughly 18,000, combining criminal and security prisoners. So Palestinian security detainees alone, not counting Palestinian criminal prisoners, just the security category, make up over 50% of everyone behind bars in the Israeli prison system. A majority of the country's incarcerated population are not Israeli citizens.
That's a structural anomaly worth sitting with. Over half the people in Israeli prisons aren't from Israel, aren't citizens of Israel, and aren't tried under Israeli civilian law. They're residents of territories under military occupation, held under a separate legal system.
That separate system is the key to understanding how we got to 9,200. Let me walk through the legal architecture, because without it, the numbers don't make sense. There are three legal instruments operating in parallel. In the West Bank, detention is governed by Military Order 1651, which gives military commanders broad authority to detain anyone deemed a security threat. For Gaza detainees, Israel applies the 1945 emergency regulations, inherited from the British Mandate, and a more recent statute called the Unlawful Combatants Law from 2002. Each framework has its own procedures, its own standards of evidence, its own review mechanisms. None of them operates like the civilian criminal code that applies inside Israel proper.
A Palestinian in Hebron and an Israeli in Tel Aviv exist in entirely different legal universes, even though the same prison service holds both.
Different arrest procedures, different evidentiary standards, different access to counsel, different visitation rights, and the most consequential difference is administrative detention.
Define that for us.
Administrative detention means imprisonment without charge or trial. The military commander issues an order based on secret evidence that neither the detainee nor their lawyer ever sees. The order lasts 6 months, and it can be renewed indefinitely. There is no upper limit. A judge reviews the evidence in a closed hearing, but the detainee is not present and has no opportunity to challenge it.
You're held on evidence you can't see, under a process you can't participate in, renewable forever.
That's the mechanism. And as of this month, about 3,400 of the 9,200 are held under administrative detention. That's roughly 37% of the total. These are people who have not been charged with any specific crime, let alone convicted.
How does that compare to historical levels?
The number of administrative detainees has increased by roughly 40% since October 2023, according to data from the Israeli human rights group Yesh Din. Before that surge, the figure hovered around 1,000 to 1,500 for years. The current level is unprecedented in the post-Second Intifada period.
This is all publicly reported data?
The Israeli Prison Service publishes monthly statistics. B'Tselem maintains a detention database that tracks individual cases. Hamokid, the Center for the Defense of the Individual, also publishes regular reports with case-level detail. The numbers are not hidden. They're available. They just require interpretation, because the categories don't map neatly onto what most people think of as a prison population.
One misconception we should address right at the top. Not all of these detainees are convicted of violent crimes. In fact, a substantial portion haven't been convicted of anything at all, as we just established with administrative detention. But even among those who are charged, the offenses cover a broad spectrum.
The security category includes people convicted of lethal attacks, yes. It also includes stone throwing, which under military law can carry sentences of up to 20 years. It includes membership in organizations that Israel has designated as unlawful. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, certain student groups, certain charities. The evidentiary threshold for proving membership is often low. Association can be enough.
There's a case documented by Hamokid in 2025 of a man held for 18 months under administrative detention. He was never told what he was accused of. His lawyer filed multiple appeals. Each time, the military judge reviewed classified material in a closed session and upheld the order. After 18 months, he was released without ever having been charged. That's not an outlier. That's the system working as designed.
That design reflects a specific legal logic. The state's position is that in an ongoing armed conflict, preventive detention is a necessary security measure, not punishment, but incapacitation. The argument is that revealing the evidence would compromise intelligence sources and methods, so the detainee carries the burden of a security assessment they can never challenge.
The logic is internally coherent. Whether it's compatible with international legal norms is a separate question, and one that's been litigated extensively.
The UN Human Rights Committee has repeatedly found that Israel's administrative detention practices violate Article 9 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which prohibits arbitrary detention. The European Union has called for an end to the practice. The International Committee of the Red Cross has documented conditions and raised concerns about compliance with the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Let's talk demographics. Who exactly are these 9,200 people?
The majority are men from the West Bank, between the ages of 18 and 40. About 160 are minors, defined under military law as ages 12 to 17. Roughly 30 are women. A small number are from Gaza, though that population has fluctuated significantly with military operations.
The minor detention piece deserves a closer look. Under Israeli military law, a minor is anyone under 18, same as in most jurisdictions. But the procedures for arresting and interrogating minors differ from the civilian system. UNICEF has documented cases of minors being arrested in night raids, blindfolded, and interrogated without a parent or lawyer present. The military courts have a separate juvenile court, but the underlying detention authority is the same.
That's where the legal architecture really shows its teeth. In the Israeli civilian system, a minor has specific protections, limits on interrogation duration, mandatory parental notification, separate detention facilities. Under military law, many of those protections are weaker or absent. The military order governs, not the youth law that applies inside Israel.
A 16-year-old Israeli citizen and a 16-year-old Palestinian in the West Bank face fundamentally different legal realities, even though the same state exercises control over both.
That's the two-track system in a nutshell. And it's not an accident or a loophole. It's the deliberate structure of the occupation's legal order.
Let's pivot to the facilities. Where are these 9,200 people actually held?
The primary facility is Ofer Prison, located near Ramallah in the West Bank. Ofer is the maximum security institution for Palestinian security detainees. It has a design capacity of about 1,500, but as of this month, it's holding over 2,000, roughly 133% occupancy.
It's overcrowded by a third.
And Ofer is significant beyond just the headcount. It's the site of the military court system where most detainees are processed. The courtroom is inside the prison complex. Detainees are brought from their cells to hearings without ever leaving the facility. It's a closed loop. Arrest, detention, trial, and imprisonment all happen within the same military infrastructure.
How many of the 9,200 are at Ofer specifically?
Approximately 2,100. That's about 23% of the total Palestinian security detainee population concentrated in a single facility.
Nearly a quarter of everyone in one prison. That's a heavy concentration.
It makes Ofer the symbolic and operational center of the detention system. The highest-risk detainees are there. People convicted of lethal attacks, senior operatives, those serving multiple life sentences. But administrative detainees are also held at Ofer, mixed in with convicted prisoners. The facility doesn't separate by legal status, only by security classification.
What about conditions?
overcrowding is the headline issue. At 133% capacity, cells designed for 6 people might hold 8 or 9. The UNR Way report from 2024 documented limited access to medical care, inadequate ventilation in summer months, and restricted family visitation. Visits are limited to once per month for 45 minutes through a glass partition with a telephone. No physical contact.
Compare that to Israeli civilian prisons.
Israeli criminal prisoners, citizens, are held in facilities run by the same prison service but under different regulations. The average occupancy rate in Israeli civilian prisons is about 95%. Visitation rights are more generous. The legal framework is the Israeli Penal Law and Prison Ordinance, not military orders. The difference isn't just in the rules on paper. It's in the entire experience of incarceration.
There's another facility worth mentioning, Ketziot Prison in the Negev Desert.
Ketziot holds about 1,000 Palestinian security detainees. It's a tent and barracks facility originally built during the First Intifada in the late 1980s. It's remote, which makes family visits extremely difficult for West Bank families who need permits to travel through Israel to reach the Negev. Megiddo Prison in the north holds about 800. The rest are distributed across smaller facilities, Ashkelon, Damon, Gilboa, and others.
Ofa is the center of gravity, but the system is geographically dispersed. What does that dispersion mean in practice?
It means families often can't visit. A detainee from Jenin in the northern West Bank might be held at Ketziot in the southern Negev, a journey of several hours that requires Israeli-issued permits for family members. Permits are frequently denied on security grounds. The Red Cross facilitates some family visits, but the logistics create what human rights groups describe as a form of collective punishment. Families punish for the alleged offenses of a relative.
That's before we get to solitary confinement.
The Israeli Prison Service acknowledges using solitary confinement as a disciplinary measure and, in some cases, for interrogation purposes. Public Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir announced in 2023 a policy of reducing detainees' already minimal rights, including restrictions on time outside cells and access to canteen services. The precise number of detainees in solitary at any given time is not publicly reported, but Hamokid and Adamir have documented individual cases of isolation lasting months.
Adamir is the Palestinian Prisoner Support Organization.
They provide legal aid and document conditions. Their reports, along with those from the Israeli groups B'Tselem and Hamokid, form the backbone of what we know about day-to-day conditions inside these facilities. The Israeli Prison Service publishes aggregate statistics, but not granular data on things like solitary confinement usage or disciplinary actions.
Let's talk about the comparison that most people don't make. You mentioned that Palestinian security detainees are over 50% of Israel's total prison population. How does that ratio compare internationally?
It's structurally unique. Most countries don't hold large numbers of non-citizen detainees under military law as a permanent feature of their prison system. The U.S. holds non-citizens in immigration detention, but that's a separate system from the federal prison population. The U.K. held Irish Republican prisoners during the Troubles, but the scale was smaller and the legal framework was different. Israel's situation, where non-citizen security detainees outnumber citizen prisoners, has no close parallel among democracies.
That's not a value judgment. It's a structural observation. The occupation creates a legal architecture that produces this outcome.
The occupation is the generating mechanism. Without the occupation, there is no military court system in the West Bank, no administrative detention orders, no Ofer prison holding 2,100 people. The numbers are downstream from the political and legal structure.
Let's address another misconception. There's a tendency to assume that Palestinian detainees are held in the same system as Israeli criminals. Same rules, same rights, same conditions. You touched on this earlier, but spell out the concrete differences.
The most fundamental difference is the governing law. An Israeli citizen accused of a crime is arrested under the criminal procedure law, brought before a civilian magistrate within 24 hours, has full access to counsel from the moment of arrest, and is tried in a civilian court with full evidentiary disclosure. A Palestinian in the West Bank is arrested under Military Order 1651, can be held for up to 8 days before seeing a judge, extendable to 90 days in some cases, and may be tried in a military court where the judge, prosecutor, and defense attorney all operate under military authority. The evidentiary standards are different. The appeal process is different. The sentencing guidelines are different.
The numbers bear this out. What's the conviction rate in military courts?
Over 99%. The military court system has a conviction rate that exceeds 99%, according to data compiled by the Israeli human rights group Yesh Din from thousands of cases. In the Israeli civilian system, the conviction rate is roughly 85%. The difference reflects the structural advantages the prosecution enjoys in the military system: broader admissibility of evidence, limited discovery rights for the defense, and the use of plea bargains negotiated under time pressure.
A 99% conviction rate isn't a justice system, it's a processing system.
That's one way to characterize it. The military courts process roughly 6,000 to 7,000 cases per year. The average hearing lasts a few minutes. Plea bargains are the norm. Most detainees never contest the charges because the incentives are structured against it. A plea deal gets you a defined sentence, while going to trial risks a much longer one and months of additional pre-trial detention.
We've established the scale, the legal architecture, and the facility concentration. What do these numbers actually tell us about the system as a whole?
The first thing they tell us is that administrative detention is the growth driver. The 40% increase since October 2023 accounts for most of the rise from roughly 7,000 detainees to the current 9,200. Military operations in the West Bank have accelerated the arrest rate, but the underlying mechanism, the ability to hold people without charge, is what allows the numbers to climb without overwhelming the military court docket.
Because if every one of those 3,400 administrative detainees had to be charged and tried, the court system would collapse under the weight.
Administrative detention is a pressure valve. It lets the security establishment incapacitate people without going through the evidentiary process that a trial requires. The 6-month renewable order is the legal instrument that makes indefinite detention possible without ever formally accusing anyone of anything.
The international response.
The International Criminal Court opened an investigation into the situation in Palestine in 2021. The treatment of detainees is within the ICC prosecutor's mandate, though no charges have been brought specifically on that issue yet. The International Court of Justice issued an advisory opinion in 2024, finding that Israel's occupation is unlawful and calling for the evacuation of settlements. The opinion addressed the detention system as part of the broader occupation infrastructure.
There's also a domestic dimension that's worth flagging. The Knesset is currently debating a bill that would formalize administrative detention for Israeli citizens.
That's right. As of this month, there's legislation under consideration that would extend administrative detention authority, historically used almost exclusively against Palestinians, to Israeli citizens deemed security threats. The bill has drawn opposition from civil liberties groups and some legal scholars who argue it would erode due process protections inside Israel proper.
The legal technology developed for the occupation is migrating inward.
That's the concern the critics have raised. Once you build the legal infrastructure for detention without trial, the temptation to apply it more broadly is always there. The bill's proponents argue it's necessary for counterterrorism. Opponents say it's a backdoor to preventative detention for political offenses.
Let's zoom back out. For a listener who wants to track these numbers themselves, where do they go?
The Israeli Prison Service publishes monthly statistical reports on its website, available in Hebrew and partially in English. B'Tselem's online database is searchable by name, date, and detention type. It's the most accessible English language resource. Hemokid publishes quarterly reports with case studies and legal analysis. Adamir tracks conditions and provides legal representation data. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, includes detention figures in its monthly humanitarian bulletin.
The numbers move. They're not static.
They fluctuate with military operations, prisoner exchanges, and political developments. During the November 2023 hostage deal, several hundred Palestinian detainees were released in exchange for Israeli hostages. The numbers dropped temporarily, then climbed again as arrests continued. So when you see a headline figure, it's a snapshot, not a fixed quantity.
One thing that's striking when you look at the data longitudinally is how normalized these numbers have become. 9,200 people in detention is treated as a routine administrative statistic rather than an extraordinary fact about the scale of incarceration.
Part of that is the security framing. When detention is presented as a necessary security measure rather than a punitive one, the numbers lose their moral weight in public discourse. Administrative detention, in particular, is framed as preventive. We're not punishing you, we're preventing you from doing something. That reframing makes indefinite detention without trial seem less troubling than it would if we called it what it functionally is, imprisonment based on secret evidence.
There's a term for that in legal scholarship, the preventive term in criminal justice, the idea that the state's primary function shifts from punishing past acts to predicting and preventing future ones. Administrative detention is the purest expression of that logic. No crime needs to be proven because the rationale isn't about what you did. It's about what you might do.
Once you accept that logic, the only limit on detention is the state's assessment of future risk. An assessment the detainee can never challenge because the evidence is secret. That's not a bug. It's the design.
We should probably address the security argument directly, because it's not frivolous. Israel faces genuine security threats. There have been attacks planned and executed by people who were previously detained and released. The security establishment's argument is that administrative detention saves lives by keeping dangerous individuals off the streets during periods of heightened tension, when the intelligence needed for a criminal conviction can't be disclosed in open court.
That's the argument, and it has force. The question is whether the scale of its use, 3,400 people, a 40% increase in 2.5 years, no maximum duration, is proportionate to the threat, or whether it has become a tool of population management rather than a targeted security measure. When 37% of your detainee population hasn't been charged with anything, the system has moved well beyond incapacitating the genuinely dangerous.
That's where the international legal framework comes in. The Fourth Geneva Convention, which Israel is a party to, allows for security detention in occupied territory, but requires that it be subject to regular review and that detainees be treated humanely. The question international bodies have raised is whether the current scale and duration of administrative detention exceeds what the convention permits.
The Israeli Supreme Court has upheld the practice, ruling in a series of cases that administrative detention is lawful under both Israeli and international law, so long as it is preventive and subject to judicial review. The debate is about whether the judicial review is meaningful when the detainee can't see the evidence and the judge only sees what the security services choose to disclose.
The review is real in form, but arguably hollow in substance.
That's the critique. A judge can ask questions about the secret evidence, but the judge can't test it against anything the defense presents because the defense is excluded. It's judicial oversight without the adversarial process that gives oversight its meaning.
Let's bring it back to OFA for a moment. You mentioned it's at 133% capacity. What does overcrowding at that level actually mean day to day?
It means less space per person, fewer hours outside the cell, more tension, more violence. Overcrowded prisons everywhere produce worse outcomes, worse health, worse mental health, more disciplinary incidents. At OFER specifically, the International Committee of the Red Cross has documented inadequate ventilation in summer, when temperatures in the West Bank can exceed 35 degrees Celsius. Cells that were designed for 6 people holding 9 means people sleeping on the floor. The prison service acknowledges the capacity issue, but says security requirements limit their ability to reduce the population.
Family visits, once a month, 45 minutes, through glass.
For a family from the northern West Bank, visiting a relative at Afer near Ramallah is logistically difficult but possible. If the detainee is transferred to Ketziot in the Negev, the visit becomes a multi-day ordeal requiring permits, checkpoints, and transportation that many families can't manage. The result is that many detainees go months without seeing their families, even though visitation is technically permitted.
That's another structural feature worth noting. The prison system doesn't just detain individuals. It punishes families, through distance, through permit regimes, through the economic impact of losing a breadwinner. The ripple effects extend well beyond the 9,200 people behind bars.
Beit Salim estimates that roughly 40% of Palestinian households in the West Bank have had at least one family member detained at some point since 1967. That's not an annual figure. That's cumulative. Detention is a near universal experience in Palestinian society, not a rare event affecting a marginal few.
40% of households. That's the kind of number that reframes how you think about the system. It's not a security measure applied to a small number of dangerous individuals. It's a mass phenomenon that touches nearly every family.
That mass character is what distinguishes the Israeli-Palestinian case from most other counterterrorism detention regimes. The scale, relative to the population, is enormous. 9,200 detainees from a West Bank and Gaza population of roughly 5 million means about 1 in every 540 Palestinians is currently in Israeli custody. For comparison, the U.S. incarceration rate is about 1 in every 200 adults, but that includes criminal prisoners, not just security detainees, and the U.S. doesn't hold a large foreign population under military law.
The per capita detention rate is in the same ballpark as the highest incarcerating countries on Earth, but it's applied to a population that isn't governed by the laws of the state holding them.
That's the anomaly. High incarceration rates exist elsewhere. What doesn't exist elsewhere is a high incarceration rate imposed by a foreign military power on a population under occupation, using a separate legal system, sustained over decades.
That brings us to the forward-looking question. Where does this go from here?
The ICC investigation is the biggest unknown. If the prosecutor brings charges related to detention practices, and that's an if, not a when, it would change the legal landscape significantly. The Knesset bill on administrative detention for Israeli citizens is another variable. If it passes, the practice expands beyond the occupied territories and becomes part of Israeli domestic law, which would likely trigger a new round of Supreme Court challenges.
The numbers themselves, are they likely to keep climbing?
That depends on the security situation. Military operations in the West Bank have intensified over the past year, and arrest rates track operational tempo fairly closely. If operations continue at the current pace, the detainee population could exceed 10,000 by the end of the year. If there's a prisoner exchange or a political agreement, the numbers could drop sharply. The system is designed to scale up quickly. It doesn't scale down as easily.
Because releasing people requires a political decision, while detaining them requires only a military order.
The asymmetry of the system is that it's far easier to add people than to remove them. Administrative detention orders are issued by a military commander with a signature. Ending them requires a review process, a judicial ruling, or a political decision to release. The institutional inertia favors growth.
For a listener trying to understand this topic, the key takeaways are 9,200 Palestinian security detainees, over half of Israel's total prison population. About 3,400 held without charge under administrative detention. Ofa prison holding roughly 23% of the total, at 133% capacity. And a legal architecture that makes all of this possible. Military orders, secret evidence, renewable detention without trial.
The data is publicly available for anyone who wants to track it. Israeli Prison Service monthly reports, Beit Salim's database, Haymokid's case documentation. The numbers are not hidden, they're published. The question is what we make of them.
Which is, I think, why the prompt asked about this in the first place. The scrutiny isn't about secret information coming to light. It's about publicly available information that doesn't get enough attention.
The scrutiny has intensified because the numbers have grown so dramatically. A 40% increase in administrative detention in under 3 years is the kind of shift that forces international organizations and foreign governments to pay attention, even if they prefer to focus elsewhere. When the UN Human Rights Committee, the ICRC, the ICC, and multiple EU bodies are all raising the same concerns about the same practice, it becomes harder to dismiss as political bias.
Yet the practice continues and the numbers keep climbing. That's the tension at the heart of this. International condemnation and domestic expansion happening simultaneously.
That's the reality of a system that operates under military authority rather than political consensus. The military commander in the West Bank doesn't need parliamentary approval to issue a detention order. The Knesset doesn't vote on each administrative detention case. The system runs on its own logic, buffered from the political process that would constrain it in a purely domestic context.
Where does that leave us? With a system that is legally complex, numerically unprecedented, and politically entrenched, Listeners who want to engage with this topic should start with the numbers. Not the rhetoric, not the competing narratives, but the data. How many people? Under what authority? In what conditions? For how long? Those are empirical questions with empirical answers, and they're the foundation for any serious discussion.
The empirical answers, as we've laid out, paint a picture of a detention system that has no close parallel among democratic states, in scale, in legal structure, and in its entanglement with a military occupation now in its sixth decade.
Let's leave it there for the main discussion. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, sepak takraw, a Southeast Asian sport where players kick a rattan ball over a net, used a ball measuring roughly 15 centimeters in diameter, which is almost exactly the width of an Aral Sea sturgeon's head at maturity. The Aral Sea basin, before its catastrophic shrinkage, was home to sturgeon that routinely reached 1.5 meters in length.
Right.
I had no idea sturgeon heads were a unit of measurement.
The things we learn.
Before we close out, one forward-looking thought. The ICC investigation into the situation in Palestine is ongoing. If the prosecutor decides to pursue charges specifically related to detention practices, administrative detention, conditions at OFER, the treatment of minors, that would represent a significant escalation in the international legal response. It's an open question whether that happens and what effect it would have on the ground.
It's worth watching. And the Nesset bill on administrative detention for citizens is another inflection point. If it passes, the practice stops being an occupation-specific tool and becomes part of Israeli domestic law. That changes the conversation entirely.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you found this useful, share it with someone who'd appreciate a data-driven look at a topic that usually generates more heat than light. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.